house he had built there, largely because it represented his faith in a future that would include himself for at least a few more years. Monroe drew the plans for the new house with his own hand, supervised the construction, and it turned out well made in the current mold, tightly covered in whitewashed clapboards outside, dark beadboard walls inside, a deep porch all across the front, attached kitchen extending from the back, a great broad fireplace in the sitting room, and wood stoves in the bedrooms, a rarity in the mountains. The Black's log cabin stood a few hundred rods up the hill toward Cold Mountain from the new house, and it became quarters for the hired help. When Monroe had bought the cove, the place had been a fully operating farm, but Monroe had soon let many parts of it lapse, for he never intended it to be self-sufficient, nor did it ever need to be if, as he had assumed, the money continued to flow from his Charleston investments in rice and indigo and cotton. Apparently, however, the money would not continue, as Ada found when she left off surveying her holdings from her perch on the ridge and drew the letter from the book in her pocket and read it. Shortly after the funeral, she had written to Monroe's friend and solicitor in Charleston, informing him of the death and asking for information on her financial position. The letter was the long-delayed response. It was brittly phrased, cautious. It discussed, as if at arm's length, the war, the embargo, the various other expressions of hard times, and their effects on Ada's income, which would be reduced, in fact, to approximately nothing, at least until the war's successful conclusion. Should the war effort be unsuccessful, Ada might realistically expect nothing forevermore. The letter ended with an offer to act as administrator of Monroe's estate, since Ada might justifiably feel ill-endowed to perform those duties herself. It was delicately suggested that the task called for judgments and knowledge outside Ada's realm. She stood and thrust the letter into her pocket and took the trail down into Black Cove. In light of the thought that the present was threat enough, and no one knows what horrid things might overtake them in the time ahead, Ada wondered where she might find the courage to search out hope. When she emerged from the big trees of the ridge, she found that the haze had burned or blown away. The sky was clear, and Cold Mountain suddenly looked close enough to reach out and touch. The day was wearing on, and the sun was bearing downward, and would in 2 hours tip below the mountains to begin the interminable high country twilight. A boomer chattered at her from its perch high in a hickory tree as she passed underneath. Shreds of nutshell fell around her. When she reached the old stone wall that marked the top of the upper pasture, she paused again. It was a lovely spot, one of her favorite corners of the farm. Lichen and moss had grown on the stones, so that the wall looked ancient, though it was not. One of the elder Blacks had apparently started it in an attempt to clear the field of stones, but had given up after only 20 feet, at which point split rails took over. The wall ran north to south, and on this sunny afternoon its west face was warm, with afternoon sun. An apple tree, a golden delicious, grew near it, and a few early ripening apples had fallen into the tall grass. Bees came to the sweet smell of rotting apples and hummed in the sunshine. The wall did not command a sweeping prospect, just a quiet view of the corner of a woodlot and a blackberry tangle and 2 big chestnut trees. Ada thought it the most peaceful place she had ever known. She settled herself into the grass at the base of the wall and rolled her shawl into a pillow. She drew the book from her pocket and began reading a chapter titled How Blackbirds Are Taken and How Blackbirds Fly. She read on and forgot herself in the tale of war and outlawry until she eventually fell asleep to the lowering sun and the sound of bees. She slept a long time, and was visited by a strong dream in which she found herself in a train depot amid a crowd of waiting passengers. There was a glass case in the center of the room, and in it stood the bones of a man, much like an anatomy display she had once seen in a museum. As she sat waiting for the train, the case filled with a blue glow, the light rising slowly, like twisting up the wick in a lantern globe. Ada saw with horror that the bones were reclothing themselves with flesh, and as the process went on, it became clear to her that her father was being reconstructed. The other passengers drew back in horror to the walls of the room, but Ada, though also terrified, walked to the glass, and put her hands to it, and waited. Monroe, however, never fully became himself. He remained but an animated corpse, the skin thin as parchment over the bones. His movements were slow yet frenzied, as a man struggling under water. He put his mouth to the glass and talked with great earnestness and urgency to Ada. His demeanor was that of one telling the most important thing he knew, but Ada, even pressing her ear to the glass, could not hear a thing other than murmuring. Then there was the sound of wind before a storm, and the case was suddenly empty. A conductor came and called the passengers to the train, and it was clear to Ada that its final destination was Charleston, in the past, and that if she got on, she would arrive at her girlhood, with the clock turned back 20 years. All the passengers boarded, and they were a jolly band, waving from the windows and smiling. Snatches of song came from some compartments. But Ada stood alone on the siding as the train rolled away. She awoke to a night sky. The rusty beacon of Mars was just slipping below the line of woodlot trees to the west. That told her it must be past the middle of the night, for she had been marking its early evening position in her notebook. A half-moon stood high in the sky. The night was dry and only a little cool. Ada unrolled the shawl and wrapped it about her. She had, of course, never spent a night in the woods alone, but she found it less frightening than she would have thought, even after her troubling dream. The moon shed a fine blue light on the woods and fields. Cold Mountain was visible only as a faint smudge of darkness across the sky. There was no sound but the call of a bobwhite from the distance. She felt no need to hurry to the house. Ada pulled the wax seal off the crock of blackberry preserves and dipped two fingers into it and scooped berries into her mouth. The preserves had been made with little sweetening and tasted fresh and sharp. Ada sat for hours and watched the progress of the moon across the sky and ate until the little crock was empty. She thought of her father in the dream and of the dark figure in the well. Though she loved Monroe deeply, she realized she was oddly affected by his appearance in her visions. She did not want him coming for her, nor did she want to follow him too immediately. Ada sat on long enough to watch the day rise. The first gray light began gathering faintly, and then, as the light built, the mountains began to form themselves, retaining the dark of night in their bulk. The fog that clung to the peaks lifted and lost the shapes of the mountains, and dissipated in the warmth of the morning. In the pasture, the forms of trees remained drawn in dew on the grass beneath them. When she stood to walk down to the house, the smell of night still lingered under the two chestnut trees. At the house, Ada took the lap desk and went to her reading chair. The hallway was in deep gloom, but for a patch of the golden light of morning that fell onto the top of the desk where it sat across her legs. The light was sectioned by the muttons of the window sash, and the air it passed through was full of hovering dust motes. Ada put her paper into one of the squares of light and wrote a quick letter thanking the lawyer for his offer, but declining it, on the grounds that at present she was of the opinion that her qualifications for administering an estate composed of nearly nothing were more than sufficient. In the hours of her night watch, she had gone over and over the possibilities before her. They were few. If she tried to sell out and return to Charleston, the little money she could hope to realize from the farm in such bad times, when buyers would be scarce, could hardly support her for long. She would, after a point, have to attach herself to friends of Monroe's, in some mildly disguised parasitic relationship, tutor, or music instructor, or the like. That or marry, and the thought of returning to Charleston as some desperate predatory spinster was appalling to her. She could imagine the scenes, spending much of what money she had on suitable wardrobe, and then negotiating matrimony with the kind of aging and ineffectual leftovers of a certain level of Charleston society, one several layers down from the top, when all the men approximately her age were off to war. All she could foresee was eventually finding herself saying to someone that she loved him, when what she would mean was that he happened to have turned up at a particularly needy time. She could not, even under the current duress, push her mind to imagine, beyond a general feeling of press and smother, the marriage act with such a one. If she returned to Charleston under those humiliating conditions, she could expect little sympathy and much withering commentary. For in the eyes of many, she had foolishly squandered the fleeting few years of courtship when young ladies were elevated to the apex of their culture, and men knelt in deference, while all of society stood at attention to watch their progress toward marriage, as if the primary moral force of the universe were focused in that direction. At the time, Monroe's friends and acquaintances had found her relative disinterest in the process puzzling. She had done little to help matters, for in the confines of ladies' parlors following dinner parties, where the mated and the mating passed sharp judgment on one another, she was prone to claim she was so dreadfully bored by suitors, all of whom seemed limited in their sphere of interests to business, hunting, and horses, that she felt she ought to have a sign fashion to read "Gentlemen Prohibited" hanging from the porch gate. She counted on such pronouncements to evoke a doctrinal response, either from one of the elders in the group or from one of the debutantes eager to ingratiate herself among those who held that the highest expression of married woman was reasonable submission to man's will. "Marriage is the end of woman," one of them would say. And Ada would respond, "Indeed, there we can agree, at least as long as we do not dwell too long on the meaning of the word located next to the last but one from your period." She delighted in the silence that followed as all present counted back to find the piece of diction in question. As a result of such behavior, it became not an uncommon opinion among their acquaintances to think that Monroe had shaped her into a type of monster, a creature not entirely fit for the society of men and women. There was, therefore, little surprise, though considerable indignation, at Ada's response to two marriage proposals during her 19th year. She rejected them out of hand, explaining later that what she found lacking in her suitors was a certain amplitude of thought, of feeling, of being. That, and the fact that both men kept their hair shiny with pomatum, as if to compensate in some visible way for their lack of sparkling wit. To many of her friends, rejection of a marriage proposal made by any man of means, who was not defective in a clear and demonstrable way, was, if not inconceivable, at least inexcusable. And in the year before their move to the mountains, many of her friends had fallen away, finding her too bristly and eccentric. Even now, return to Charleston was a bitter thought, and one that her pride rejected. There was nothing pulling her back there, certainly not family. She had no relatives closer than her cousin Lucy, no kindly aunts or doting grandparents welcoming her return. And that state of kinlessness, too, was a bitter thought, considering that all around her the mountain people were bound together in ties of clan so extensive and firm that they could hardly walk a mile along the river road without coming upon a relative. But still, outsider though she was, this place, the Blue Mountains, seemed to be holding her where she was. From any direction she came at it, the only conclusion that left her any hope of self-content was this: what she could see around her was all that she could count on. The mountains and a desire to find if she could make a satisfactory life of common things here, together they seemed to offer the promise of a more content and expansive life, though she could in no way picture even its starkest outlines. It was easy enough to say, as Monroe often did, that the path to contentment was to abide by one's own nature and follow its path. Such, she believed, was clearly true. But if one had not the slightest hint toward finding what one's nature was, then even stepping out on the path became a snaggy matter. She therefore sat at the window that morning, wondering sincerely and with some confusion what her next action should be, when she saw a figure come walking up the road. As it neared the house, Ada resolved the figure into a girl of sorts, a short one, thin as a chicken neck except across the points of her sharp hip bones, where she was of substantial width. Ada went to the porch and sat, waiting to see what this person might want. The girl came up to the porch, and without asking leave sat in a rocker next to Ada and hooked her heels on the chair rungs. She started rocking. As a structure, she was stable as a drag sled, low in her center of gravity, but knobby and slight in all the extremities. She wore a square-necked dress of coarse homespun cloth, the dusty color of blue that comes from dye made of the inside of ragweed galls. "Old Lady Swanger said you're in need of help," she said. Ada examined the girl further. She was a dark thing, corded through the neck and arms, frail-chested. Her hair was black and coarse as a horse's tail, broad across the bridge of her nose, big dark eyes virtually pupilless, the whites of them startling in their clarity. She went shoeless, but her feet were clean. The nails to her toes were pale and silver as fish scales. "Mrs. Swanger is right, I do need help," Ada said, "but what I need is in the way of rough work, plowing, planting, harvesting, woodcutting, and the like. This place has to be made self-sufficient. I believe I need a man hand for the job." "Number one," the girl said, "if you've got a horse, I can plow all day. Number two, old Lady Swanger told me your straits. Something for you to keep in mind would be that every man worth hiring is often gone. It's a harsh truth, but that's mostly the way of things, even under favorable conditions." The girl's name, Ada soon discovered, was Ruby, and though the look of her was not confidence-inspiring, she convincingly depicted herself as capable of any and all farm tasks. Just as importantly, as they talked, Ada found that she was enormously cheered by Ruby. Ada's deep impression was that she had a willing heart, and though Ruby had not spent a day of her life in school and could not read a word nor write even her name, Ada thought she saw in her a spark as bright and hard as one struck with steel and flint. And there was this. Like Ada, Ruby was a motherless child from the day she was born. They had that to understand each other by, though otherwise they could not have been more alien to each other. In short order, and somewhat to Ada's surprise, they began striking a deal. Ruby said, "I've not ever hired out as hand or servant, and I've not heard good things told about taking on such a job. But Sally said you needed help, and she was right. What I'm saying is we have to come to some terms." This is where we talk about money, Ada thought. Monroe had never consulted her in the matter of hiring, but she was under the impression that the help did not ordinarily lay down conditions for their employment. She said, "Right this minute, and possibly for some time to come, money is in short supply." "Money's not it," Ruby said. "Like I said, I'm not exactly looking to hire out. I'm saying if I'm to help you here, it's with both us knowing that everybody empties their own night jar." Ada started to laugh, but then realized this was not meant to be funny. "Something on the order of equality," was Ruby's demand. It seemed, from Ada's point of view, an odd one. But on reflection, she decided that since no one else was lined up to help her, and since she had been tossing her own slops all summer, the request was fair enough. As they talked over the remaining details, the yellow and black rooster walked by the porch and paused to stare at them. He twitched his head and flipped his red comb from one side of his head to the other. "I despise that bird," Ada said. "He tried to flog me." Ruby said, "I'd not keep a flogging rooster." "Then how might we run it off?" Ada said. Ruby looked at her with a great deal of puzzlement. She rose and stepped off the porch, and in one swift motion snatched up the rooster, tucked his body under her left arm, and with her right hand pulled off his head. He struggled under her arm for a minute and then fell still. Ruby threw the head off into a barberry bush by the fence. "He'll be stringy, so we'd best stew him for a while," Ruby said. By dinner time, the meat of the rooster was falling from the bone, and gobs of biscuit dough the size of cat heads cooked in the yellow broth. The Color of Despair. At another time, the scene might have had about it a note of the jaunty. All the elements that composed it suggested the legendary freedom of the open road, the dawn of day, sunlight golden and at a low angle. A cart path bordered on one side by red maples, on the other by a split-rail fence. A tall man in a slouch hat, a knapsack on his back, walking west. But after such wet and miserable nights as he had recently passed, Inman felt like God's most marauded battling. He stopped and put a boot on the bottom rail of the roadside fence and looked out across the dewy fields. He tried to greet the day with a thankful heart, but in the early pale light his first true vision was of some foul variety of brown flatland viper sliding flabby and turd-like from the roadway into a thick bed of chickweed. Beyond the fields stood flatwoods, nothing but trash trees, jackpine, slash pine, red cedar. Inman hated these planed-off places, tangled pine breaks, all this flat land, red dirt, mean towns. He had fought over ground like this, from the Piedmont to the sea, and it seemed like nothing but the place where all that was foul and sorry had flowed downhill and pooled in the low spots. Country of swill and sullage, sump of the continent. A miry slough indeed, and he could take little more of it. Out in the woods, cicadas shrilled all around, near and far, a pulsing screech like the sound of many jagged pieces of dry bone twisting against each other. So dense was the noise that it came to seem a vibration conceived inside Inman's head from the jangle of his own troubled mind, a personal affliction rather than a sensation of the general world shared by all. The wound at his neck felt freshly raw, and it throbbed with every pulse of cicadas. He ran a finger up under the dressing, half expecting to feel a place as deep and red as a gill slit, but instead what he found was a great crusted welt at his collar line. He calculated that his days of traveling had put little distance between himself and the hospital. His condition had required him to walk more slowly and to rest more often than he would have liked, and he had been able to cover only a few miles at a time, and even that slow pace had been at considerable cost. He was bone-tired, and at least partially lost, still trying to find a pathway bearing directly west toward home. But the country had been one of small farmsteads, all cut up by a welter of interlaced roads, none marked by any signpost to announce it as more likely westering than another. He kept feeling that he had been led farther south than he wanted, and the weather had been bad, hard rain off and on through the period. Sudden downpours, with thunder and lightning both day and night. The small clapboard farmhouses had lain close spaced one to the other, with cornfields all but run together, and nothing but fence rails to mark one man's place from the next. Each farm had two or three vicious hounds set to go off at the merest sound, rushing barkless and low out of the dark shadows of roadside trees to rip at his legs with jaws like scythes. The first night he had kicked away several attacks, and a spotted bitch pierced the hide of his calf as if with a leather punch. After that he had looked for weaponry and found a stout locust limb in a ditch. With some little effort he had beat off the next dog that bit at him, striking at it with short downward blows like tamping dirt around a new set post. Through much of that night, and the ones thereafter, he had clubbed dogs off with dull percussion to send them scooting back, still soundless, into the dark. The dogs, and the threat of home guard out prowling, and the gloom of the cloudy nights made for nervous wayfaring. The night just passed had been the worst. The clouds had broken open and revealed meteors flinging themselves out of an empty point of sky. They had shot in on whizzing trajectories that Inman took to be aimed decidedly himward, little projectiles flung from on high. Later, a great fireball had come roaring out of the dark, moving slow but aimed to land directly atop Inman. Before it had reached him, though, it simply disappeared, like a candle flame pinched out with spittled finger and thumb. The fireball had been close followed by some stub-winged whooshing nightbird or hog-faced bat, flicking low to Inman's head, causing him to duck and walk stooped for three full strides. Then presently a passing luna moth flashed open its great eye-spotted wings directly in front of Inman's nose, and he had mistaken it for some bizarre green dream face thrust suddenly at him out of the dark with a message to speak. Inman had yelped and struck out at the air before him with hard blows that hit nothing. Later he had heard the beat of horses cantering, and had climbed a tree and watched as a pack of guard rumbled by, seeking out just such a one as himself to seize and thrash and return to service. When he had climbed down and begun walking again, every tree stump seemed to take on the shape of a lurker in the dark, and he once pulled his pistol on a scraggly myrtle bush that looked like a big-headed fat man. Crossing a sunken creek long after midnight, he had reached a finger down into the wet clay bank and daubed on the breast of his jacket two concentric circles with a dot at the center, and walked on, marked as the butt of the celestial realm, a night traveler, a fugitive, an outlier, thinking, "This journey will be the axle of my life." That long night accomplished, his greatest desire now was to climb over the fence and walk out across that old field into the flatwoods, then up in the pines and sleep. But having at last reached open country, he needed to move on. so he took his foot off the fence rail and addressed himself anew to his travels. The sun climbed the sky and turned hot, and all the insect world seemed to find Inman's bodily fluids fascinating. Striped mosquitoes hummed around his ears and bit his back through his shirt. Ticks dropped from trailside brush and attached themselves to him at hairline and pant waist and grew fat. Gnats sought out the water in his eyes. A horsefly followed him for a while, troubling his neck. It was a big black glob of buzzing matter the size of the end joint to his thumb, and he longed to kill it, but could not, no matter how he jerked and beat at himself, as it landed to bite out gouts of flesh and blood. The blows rang out in the still air. From a distance, he would have seemed one of a musical temper, experimenting with a new method of percussion, or a loose bedlamite, at odds with his better nature and striking out flat-palmed with self-loathing. He stopped and pissed in the dirt. Before he was hardly done, spring azure butterflies alit on it to drink, the color of their wings in the sun like blued metal. They seemed to him things too beautiful to be drinking piss. It was, though, apparently the nature of the place. In the afternoon he came to a crossroads settlement. He stopped at the edge of town and surveyed the scene. There was but a store, a few houses, a lean-to where a smith peddled a wheel, sharpening the long blade of a scythe. Grinding it wrongly, Inman noted, for the smith was sharpening away from the cutting edge rather than toward, and holding the blade at right angles to the wheel rather than diagonal. There were no other people moving about the town. Inman decided to risk going to the whitewashed store to buy food. He stuck his pistol in the folds of the blanket roll, so as to look harmless and not draw attention. Two men sitting on the porch to the store hardly looked up as he mounted the steps. One man was hatless, his hair sticking up on one side as if he had just risen from bed and not even run his fingers across his head. He was deeply engaged in cleaning his fingernails with the nipple pick to a rifle musket. All his faculties were so fully brought to bear on the task that the tip of his tongue, gray as the foot of a goose, was stuck out at the corner of his mouth. The other man was studying a newspaper. He wore leavings from a uniform, but the bill to his forage cap had been torn off so that the crown alone topped his head like a gray tarbush. It was cocked off to the side at a sharp angle, and Inman supposed the man styled himself as a rounder. Propped up against the wall behind the man was a fine Whitworth rifle, an elaborate brass-scoped artifact with many complex little wheels and screws to adjust for windage and elevation. The hexagonal barrel was plugged with a tompion of maple wood to keep out dirt. Inman had seen but a few Whitworths before. They were favorites of snipers, imported from England, as were their scarce and expensive paper tube cartridges. At 45 caliber, they were not awesome in power, but they were frightfully accurate at distances up to near a mile. If you could see it, and had even a measure of skill and marksmanship, a Whitworth could hit it. Inman wondered how men like these might come by such a fine rifle. He walked past them, into the store, and they still did not look up. Inside by the fire, two old men played a game on a barrel top. One man put his hand out on the circle of wood and spread his fingers. The other stabbed at the spaces between the fingers with the point of a pocket knife. Inman watched a minute, but could not figure out what the rules might be, nor how score might be kept, nor what might need to occur so that one or the other would be declared the victor. From the store's meager stock, Inman bought 5 pounds of cornmeal, a piece of cheese, some dried biscuit, and a big sweet pickle, and then he went out onto the porch. The two men were gone, had left so recently that their rockers were still in motion. Inman stepped down into the road to go on walking west, eating as he traveled. In front of him, a pair of black dogs crossed from one patch of shade to another. Then, as Inman came to the edge of the town, the two men who had been on the porch came from behind the smithy and stood in the road blocking his way out. The smith stopped pedaling the wheel and stood watching. "Where you going, son of a bitch?" the man with the cap said. Inman said nothing. He ate the wet pickle in two big bites and stuck the remainder of the cheese and biscuit in the haversack. The nipple-pick man moved off to the side of him. The smith, wearing a heavy leather apron and carrying the scythe, came out of the lean-to and circled around to come at Inman from the other side. They were not big men, not even the smith, who seemed in all ways unsuited to his craft. They looked to be layabouts, drunk maybe, and overconfident, for they appeared to presume, since numbers were in their favor, that they could take him with no more weapon than the scythe. Inman had begun to reach behind him into the roll of his bedding when the three jumped as one, swarming at him. At once they were fighting in fist and skull. He had not time even to remove his pack and thus brawled encumbered. Inman fought them backing up. His last wish was for them to mob him over onto the ground, and so he gave way until he was forced against the side of the store. The smith took a step back and came over his head with the scythe like a man splitting wood. His thinking, apparently, was to cleave Inman down the center, cut him open from collarbone to groin. But it was an awkward blow, made doubly so by the shape of the implement. He missed by a foot, and the point of the blade buried itself in the dirt. Inman jerked the scythe from the smith's hands and used it as it was intended, making long sweeping strokes close to the ground. He went at their feet with it, mowing at them, and making them drop back before they were cut off at the ankles. It felt natural to him, holding a scythe in his hands again and working with it, though the current effort was different from mowing fodder, since his strokes were hard, hoping as he was to strike bone. But even under these unfavorable circumstances, he found that all the elements of scything, the way you hold it, the wide-footed way you stand, the heel-down angle of the blade to the plane of the ground, fell into the old pattern and struck him as being a thing he could do to some actual effect. The men skipped and dodged about to avoid the long blade, but soon they regrouped and swarmed again. Inman went to slash at the shin bones of the smith, but the blade clashed on the stone of the foundation and threw a spray of white sparks and broke off close so that he was left holding but the snath. He fought on with it, though it made a poor cudgel, long and misbalanced and awkwardly curved as it was. In the end, though, it was adequate, for he eventually smote the three down to their knees in the dirt of the street, so they looked like those of the Romish faith at prayer. Then he kept at it until they all lay prone and quiet, faces down. He threw the snath off across the road into a patch of ragweed, but as soon as he did it, the smith rolled over and raised up weakly and pulled a small-caliber revolver from under his apron and began drawing a shaky bead on Inman. Inman said, "Shit fire." He palmed the little weapon away and stuck it to the man's head just below an eye and commenced pulling the trigger out of sheer frustration with the willfulness of these sorry off-scourings. The caps, though, were damp or otherwise faulty, and the pistol snapped on four chambers before he gave up and beat the man about the head with it and flung it onto the top of the building and walked away. Outside of town, he turned into the woods and walked roadless to elude pursuers. All through the afternoon, the best he could do was to continue westering among pine trunks, thrashing his way through brush, stopping now and again to listen for anyone following. Sometimes he thought he heard voices in the distance, but they were faint and might have been imagination, as when one sleeps near a river and all night thinks he hears conversation pitched too low for understanding. There was no baying of hounds, and so Inman reckoned that even if the voices were the men from town, he was safe enough, especially with night coming on. For course setting, Inman had the sun wheeling above him, its light broken by the pine boughs, and he followed as it slid off toward the western edge of the earth. As Inman walked, he thought of a spell Swimmer had taught him, one of particular potency. It was called to destroy life, and the words of it formed themselves over and over in his mind. Swimmer had said that it only worked in Cherokee, not in English, and that there was no consequence in teaching it to Inman. But Inman thought all words had some issue, so he walked and said the spell, aiming it out against the world at large, all his enemies. He repeated it over and over to himself, as some people in fear or hope will say a single prayer endlessly until it burns itself in their thoughts so that they can work or even carry on a conversation with it still running unimpeded. The words Inman remembered were these: "Listen, your path will stretch up toward the nightland. You will be lonely. You will be like the dog in heat. You will carry dog shit before you in your cupped hands. You will howl like a dog as you walk alone toward the nightland. You will be smeared with dog shit. It will cling to you. Your black guts will be hanging all about you. They will whip about your feet as you walk. You will be living fitfully. Your soul will fade to blue, the color of despair. Your spirit will wane and dwindle away, never to reappear. Your path lies toward the nightland. This is your path. There is no other. Inman carried on this way for some miles, but for all he could tell, the words were just flying back to strike him alone. And then after a while, the sentiments of Swimmer's words brought to mind a sermon of Monroe's, one dense to the point of clotting with quotations from various sages, as was Monroe's habit. It had taken for text not some Bible verse, but a baffling passage from Emerson, and Inman found in it some similarity to the spell, though all in all he preferred Swimmer's wording. What Inman remembered was this passage, which Monroe had repeated four times at dramatic intervals throughout the sermon. That which shows God in me fortifies me. That which shows God out of me makes me a wart and a wen. There is no longer a necessary reason for my being. Already the long shadows of untimely oblivion creep over me, and I shall decrease forever. Inman thought that had been the best sermon he had ever heard, and Monroe had delivered it on the day Inman first saw Ada. Inman had attended church expressly for the purpose of viewing her. In the weeks following Ada's arrival in Cold Mountain, Inman had heard much about her before he saw her. She and her father stayed too long green in the country they had taken up, and they soon became a source of great comedy to many households along the river road. For people to sit on the porch and watch Ada and Monroe pass by in the cabriolet or see Ada on one of her nature walks along the big road was as near to theater as most would come, and she provoked as much discussion as a new production at the Dock Street Opera. All agreed that she was pretty enough, but her very choice of Charleston garb or flourish of hairstyle was subject to ridicule. If she were seen holding a stem of beard-tongue blossoms to admire their color, or stooping to touch the spikes of jimson leaves, some would solemnly call her mazed in the head not to know beard-tongue when she saw it. And others would wonder, grinning, was she so wit-scoured as perhaps to eat jimson? Gossip had it that she went about with a notebook and pencil, and would stare at a thing, bird or bush, weed, sunset, mountain, and then scratch at paper a while, as if she were addled enough in her thinking that she might forget what was important to her if she did not mark it down. So one Sunday morning, Inman dressed himself carefully in a new black suit, white shirt, black tie, black hat, and set out for church to view Ada. It was a time of blackberry winter, and a chill rain had fallen without pause for 3 days, and though the rain had stopped sometime in the night, the morning sun had not yet burned through the clouds, and the slash of sky visible between the ridge lines was dark and low and utterly without feature. The roads were nothing but sucking mud, and so Inman had arrived late and taken a seat at a rear pew. There was already a hymn going. Someone had lit a greenwood fire in the stove. It smoked from around the top plate, and the smoke rose to the ceiling and spread flat against the beadboards and hung there gray like a miniature of the actual sky. Inman had but the back of her head to find Ada by, yet that took only a moment, since her dark hair was done up in a heavy and intricate plait of such recent fashion that it was not then known in the mountains. Below where her hair was twisted up, 2 faint cords of muscle ran up under the skin on either side of her white neck to hold her head on. Between them a scoop, a shaded hollow of skin. Curls too fine to be worked up into the plait. All through the hymn, Inman's eyes rested there, so that after a while, even before he saw her face, all he wanted was to press 2 fingertips against that mystery place. Monroe began the sermon by commenting on the hymn they had all just mouthed. Its words seemed to look with passionate yearning to a time when they would be immersed in an ocean of love. But Monroe preached that they were misunderstanding the song if they fooled themselves into thinking all creation would someday love them. What it really required was for them to love all creation. That was altogether a more difficult thing, and, to judge by the congregation's reaction, somewhat shocking and distressful. The remainder of the sermon took the same topic as all others of Monroe's since his arrival in Cold Mountain. Sundays and Wednesdays both he had talked only of what he thought to be the prime riddle of creation. Why was man born to die? It made no sense on the face of it. Over the weeks he had tried coming at the question from every direction, what the Bible had to say on the matter, how wise men of many lands and all of known time had reasoned it out, revelatory metaphors from nature. Monroe tested every hold he could devise to get purchase on it, all without success. After several weeks, grumbling in the congregation made it clear that death troubled him to a greater degree than it did them. Many thought it not the tragedy Monroe did, but saw it rather as a good thing. They were looking forward to the rest. Monroe's thoughts would sit smoother, some had suggested, if he went back to doing what the old dead preacher had done, mainly condemn sinners and tell Bible tales with entertaining zeal, baby Moses in the bulrush, boy David slinging rocks. Monroe had declined the advice, saying to one elder that such was not his mission. That comment had gotten itself passed all about the community, the general interpretation being that his use of the word mission set the congregation in the position of benighted savages. They had, many of them, put up cash money to send missionaries among true savages, folks they pictured in skins of various dim colors, living in locales they conceived of as infinitely more remote and heathen than their own, and so the remark did not pass easily. To wet down the fires that were rising around his ministry, Monroe had therefore begun his sermon on the Sunday in question by explaining how every man and woman had a mission. The word meant no more nor less than a job of work, he said. It was one job of his to think about why a man was born to die, and he was inclined to go on at it with at least the perseverance of a man with a horse to break or a field to clear of stones. And he did go on, at length. Throughout the preachment that morning, Inman sat staring at Ada's neck and listening as Monroe repeated four times the Emerson passage about warts and winds and decreasing forever. When the service concluded, the men and women left the church by their separate doors. Muddy horses stood asleep in their traces, their rigs and traps behind them mired up to the spokes in mud. The voices of the people awoke them, and one chestnut mare shook her hide with the sound of flapping a dirty carpet. The churchyard was filled with the smell of mud and wet leaves and wet clothes and wet horses. The men lined up to shake hands with Monroe, and then they all milled about the wet churchyard visiting and speculating on whether the rain had quit or was just resting. Some of the elders talked in low voices about the queerness of Monroe's sermon and its lack of scripture, and about how they admired his stubbornness in the face of other people's desires. The unmarried men wadded up together, standing with their muddy boots and spattered pant cuffs in a circle. Their talk had more of Saturday night to it than Sunday morning, and all of them periodically cut their eyes to where Ada stood at the edge of the graveyard, looking altogether foreign and beautiful and utterly awkward. Everyone else wore woolens against the damp chill, but Ada had on an ivory-colored linen dress with lace at the collar and sleeves and hem. She seemed to have chosen it more by the calendar than the weather. She stood holding her elbows. The older women came to her and said things, and then there were knotty pauses, and then they went away. Inman noted that every time she was approached, Ada took a step back, until she fetched up against the headstone of a man who had fought in the Revolution. "If I went and told her my name, reckon she'd say ought to me back," said a Dillard man who'd come to church for precisely the same reason Inman had. "I couldn't say," Inman said. "You'd not begin to know where to start courting her," Hob Mars said to Dillard. "Best leave that to me." Mars was shortish and big through the chest. He had a fat watch that pooched out his vest pocket and a silver chain that ran to his pant waist and a scrolled fob hanging from the chain. Dillard said, "You think you bore with a mighty big auger." "I don't think it, I know it," Mars said. Then another man, one of such slight build and irregular features that he was but a bystander, said, "I'd bet $100 against a half a ginger cake that she's got a husband elect down in Charleston." "They can be forgot," Hob said, "many has been before." Then Hob stared at Inman and surveyed his strict attire. "You look like the law," he said. "A man courtin' needs some color about him." Inman could see that they would all talk the topic round and round until one or another that day might eventually draw up the nerve to go to her and make a fool of himself. Or else they would insult each other until a pair of them would have to meet down the road and fight. So he touched a finger to his brow and said, "Boys," and walked away. He went straight over to Sally Swanger and said, "I'd clear an acre of new ground for an introduction." Sally had on a bonnet with a long bill to it, so that she had to step back and cock her head to throw the shade off her eyes and look up at Inman. She grinned at him and put her hand up, touched a pinchbeck brooch at her collar, and rubbed her fingers across it. "Notice I'm not even asking who to," she said. "Now would be the time," Inman said, looking to where Ada stood alone, her back to the people, slightly stooped, peering in apparent fascination at the inscription on the gravestone. The bottom foot of her dress was wet from the tall grave grass, and the tail of it had sometime dragged in mud. Mrs. Swanger took Inman's black coat sleeve between finger and thumb and pulled him by such slight harness across the yard to Ada. When his sleeve was let go, he raised the hand to take off his hat, then with the other he raked through his hair all around where it was pressed and banded. He swept the hair back at each temple and rubbed his palm from brow to chin to compose his face. Mrs. Swanger cleared her throat, and Ada turned around. "Miss Monroe," Sally Swanger said, her face bright, "Mr. Inman has expressed a deep interest in becoming acquainted. You've met his parents. His people built the chapel," she added by way of reference, before she walked away. Ada looked Inman directly in the face, and he realized too late that he had not planned what to say. Before he could formulate a phrase, Ada said, "Yes." There was not much patience in her voice, and for some reason Inman found that amusing. He looked off to the side, down toward where the river bent around the hill, and tried to bring down the corners of his mouth. The leaves on trees and rhododendron at the river banks were glossed and drooping with the weight of water. The river ran heavy and dark in curves like melted glass, where it bowed over hidden rocks and then sank into troughs. Inman held his hat by the crown, and for lack of anything to say, he looked down into the hole, as if from previous experience. He waited in sincere expectation that something might emerge. Ada stood a moment looking at his face, and then after a time she looked into the hole of the hat, too. Inman caught himself, fearing that the expression on his face was that of a dog sitting at the lip of a groundhog burrow. He looked at Ada, and she turned up her palms and raised an eyebrow to signify a general question. "You're free to put your hat back on and say something," she said. "It's just that you've been the subject of considerable speculation," Inman said. "Like a novelty, is it, speaking to me?" she said. "No." "A challenge, then, perhaps from that circle of dullards there?" "Not at all." "Well, then you supply the simile," Ada said. "Like grabbing up a chestnut burr, at least thus far." Ada smiled and nodded. She had not figured him to know the word. Then she said, "Tell me this. A woman earlier commented on the recent weather. She called it sheep-killing weather. I've been wondering, can't get it out of my mind, did she mean weather appropriate for slaughtering sheep, or weather foul enough to kill them itself without assistance, perhaps by drowning or pneumonia?" "The first," Inman said. "Well, then I thank you," Ada said. "You've served a useful purpose." She turned and walked away to her father. Inman watched her touch Monroe's arm and say something to him, and they went to the cabriolet and climbed in and wheeled off, fading down the lane between fence rows thicketed with blossoming blackberry canes. Eventually, late in the day, Inman emerged from out the foul pine woods and found himself wandering the banks of a great swollen river. The sun stood just above the low horizon at the far bank, and there was a haze in the air, so that everything was cast in a lurid yellow light. The rain had evidently been harder somewhere upstream and had raised the river to its banks and beyond, too wide and strong to swim, even had Inman been a good swimmer. So hoping to find an unguarded bridge or trestle, he walked up the riverbank following a thin footpath that ran between the grim pine forest to his right and the sorry river to his left. It was a foul region, planed off flat except where there were raw gullies cut deep in the red clay, scrubby pines everywhere. Trees of a better make had once stood in their place but had been cut down long ago, the only evidence of them now an occasional hardwood stump as big around as a dinner table. Poison ivy grew in thick beds that stretched as far as Inman could see through the woods. It climbed the pine trees and spread among their limbs. The falling needles caught in the tangled ivy vines and softened the lines of the trunks and limbs and formed heavy new shapes of them, until the trees loomed like green and gray beasts risen out of the ground. The forest looked to be a sick and dangerous place. It recalled to him a time during the fighting down along the coast when a man had shown him a tiny plant, a strange and hairy thing that grew in bogs. It knew to eat meat, and they fed it little pieces of fat back from the end of a splinter. You could hold the tip of a finger to what stood for its mouth, and it would snap at you. These flatwoods seemed only a step away from learning the trick on a grander scale. What Inman wanted was to be out of there, but the river stretched wide before him, a shit-brown clog to his passage. As a liquid, it bore likeness more to molasses as it first thickens in the making than to water. He wished never to become accustomed to this sorry make of waterway. It did not even fit his picture of a river. Where he was from, the word river meant rocks and moss, and the sound of white water moving fast under the spell of a great deal of collected gravity. Not a river in his whole territory was wider than you could pitch a stick across, and in every one of them you could see bottom wherever you looked. This broad ditch was a smear on the landscape. But for the balls of yellow scud collected in drifted foamy heaps upstream of grounded logs, the river was as opaque and unmarked as a sheet of tin painted brown, foul as the contents of an outhouse pit. Inman fared on through this territory, criticizing its every feature. How did he ever think this to be his country and worth fighting for? Ignorance alone would account for it. All he could list in his mind worth combat right now was his right to exist unmolested somewhere on the West Fork of the Pigeon River drainage basin, up on Cold Mountain, near the source of Scape Cat Branch. He thought on homeland, the big timber, the air thin and chill all the year long, tulip poplars so big through the trunk they put you in mind of locomotives set on end. He thought of getting home and building him a cabin on Cold Mountain, so high that not a soul but the nighthawks passing across the clouds in autumn would hear his sad cry, of living a life so quiet he would not need ears. And if Ada would go with him, there might be the hope, so far off in the distance he did not even really see it, that in time his despair might be honed off to a point so fine and thin that it would be nearly the same as vanishing. But even though he believed truly that you can think on a thing till it comes real, this last thought never shaped up so, no matter how hard he tried. What hope he had was no brighter than if someone had lit fire to a taper at the mountain's top and left him far away to try setting a course by it. He walked on, and shortly night began to fall, and a part of a moon shone through patchy clouds. He came upon a road that ended in the river. Beside it, a sign that someone had stuck up at the river's edge read, "Ferry, $5," yelled loud. A stout rope stretched from a thick post across the water and disappeared into it. Toward the far bank, the rope rose from the water again to end at another post. Beyond the landing, Inman saw a house on stilts raised above the high water mark. A window was lit, and smoke came from the chimney. Inman called out, and in a minute a figure appeared on the porch and waved and went back in. Soon, though, it reappeared from behind the house, dragging a dugout canoe by a line. The boatman got it afloat and mounted it and set out rowing hard upstream in the slower water that flowed near the bank. Still, it was a strong current, and he dug with bowed back at the paddle until it looked like he planned to just keep on going. Before he went out of sight, though, he turned and sat up and let the current carry him down, angling to the east bank, working easily, saving effort, just barely touching the blade to the water to set a course. The dugout was old, and the dry wood was sun-bleached, so that the crude and blockish sides of it shone like beaten pewter against the dark water when the moon broke from between clouds. As the canoe came into shore where Inman stood, he saw that it was piloted by no ferryman, but an apple-cheeked girl, dark about the head and skin so as to suggest Indian blood back a generation or two. She wore a dress of homespun that in the dim light he took to be yellow. She had big, strong hands, and the muscles of her forearms knotted under the skin with every stroke. Her black hair was loose about her shoulders. She whistled a tune as she approached. At the bank, she stepped out of the dugout, barefooted, into the muddy water, pulling the canoe by a line at its bow to beach it. Inman drew a $5 note from his pocket and reached it to her. She didn't reach to take it, but only looked at it with some measure of disgust. "I wouldn't give a thirsty man a dipper of this river water for $5, much less paddle you across it," she said. "The sign says the ferry charge is $5, Inman said. "This look like a ferry boat to you?" "Is this a ferry crossing or not?" he said. It is when Daddy's here. He's got a flatboat big enough to carry a team and wagon. He pulls it across on the rope. But with the river up, he can't run it. He's gone off hunting, waiting for the water to drop. Till then, I'm charging the utmost somebody's willing to pay. For I've got me a cowhide, and I aim to get a saddle made from it. And when I get me that, I'll start saving for a horse. And when I get one, I'll throw the saddle over it and turn my back to this river and be gone. What's the name of this thing? Inman said. Why, it's nothing but the mighty Cape Fear River, is all, the girl said. Well, what will you charge me to get over it? Inman said. $50 scrip, the girl said. Take 20. Let's go, she said. Before they could climb into the boat, Inman saw great greasy bubbles rising to the surface 30 feet out from the bank. They shone in the moonlight as they broke, and they moved in a direction counter to the river's flow, going upstream at about the pace of a man walking. The night was windless and still, and there were not other sounds than the water blubbering and the bugs skirling in the pines. You see that? Inman said. Yeah, the girl said. What's making it? Hard to say, she said, it being at the bottom of the river. The water broke as huge and urgent as breath from a drowning cow. Inman and the girl stood and watched as the bubbles gradually climbed the river until the moon was overblown by a bank of clouds and they disappeared in the darkness. Could be a catfish rooting along the river bottom to dig up some food, the girl said. They've got a diet would kill a turkey vulture. I seen one the size of a boar hog one time. It was washed up dead on a sandbar. Whiskers on it, size of black snakes. Well, that would be the sort of thing that would grow in this river, Inman figured. Monstrous, flabby fish with meat as slack as fat back. He thought of the great contrast between such a creature and the little trout that lived in the upper branches of the Pigeon where the water poured off Cold Mountain. They were seldom longer than your hand, bright and firm as shavings from a bar of silver. Inman tossed his packs in ahead of him, and boarded the canoe and settled himself in the prow. The girl got in behind him and dug hard against the water, paddling with a strong and sure hand, keeping a straight course by kicking out at the tail of the stroke rather than constantly switching sides. The splash of the paddle overrode even the insects squealing. The girl dug hard at the water to send them a fair piece up the river from the landing, taking advantage of the slower water near the bank. Then she turned about and quit paddling and stuck the blade in the water like a rudder. She angled them out, using the current to drive them toward the river's midpoint. With the moon hidden, the land beyond the riverbank soon disappeared, and they floated blind, in a world black as the inside of a cow. In the silence, they heard the sound of voices from the eastern landing, carrying far across the water. It might have been anybody. Inman doubted the men from the town had enough purpose to follow him so far. Still, he turned and, whispering, said to the girl, "We'd best not be found out." But at that moment he looked up and saw a radius of moon appear from under clouds. It soon stood fully revealed in a little ragged window of sky. The sun-bleached side of the canoe shone out like a beacon on the dark water. There was a sound like running fingernails across the grain of corduroy, and a whacking sound. The crack of gunfire followed. The Whitworth, Inman thought. A hole opened up at the back of the canoe at waterline. Brown water streamed in at the alarming rate of a cow pissing. Inman looked ahead to the landing and saw a party of a half-dozen men milling about in the moonlight. Some of them began firing their little pistols, but they had not the carrying power to cover the distance. The man with the rifle, though, had it turned up and was working with the ramrod to tamp in a fresh load. The only way Inman could figure it, the men must have framed the evening in their minds as a type of coon hunt, as sport. Otherwise, they would have long since gone back to town. The ferry girl sized up the situation immediately and threw her weight to rock the canoe hard, tipping it to the gunwales to wet it down and darken it. Inman tore the cuff off his shirt and was plugging the hole when another ball struck the side at waterline and tore off a chunk of wood as big as a hand. The river poured in and soon began filling the bottom of the boat. "There's nothing else but that we are going to have to get down in this river," the girl said. Inman first thought she intended them to strike out swimming for sure. Not having come from a country of deep water, though, he doubted his ability to swim that far. Instead, she proposed they get in the water and hold to the canoe, using it for cover. Inman wrapped his packs with his oilcloth and tied the bundle off tight as he could with the loose ends, in case the canoe should sink entirely. Then together, he and the girl threw themselves into the river to let the current take them, bearing them up